You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, many poor countries have struggled to get access to COVID-19 vaccines and medications to treat the virus. We'll find out why and some of the latest efforts to change that. Now, the State Department of Public Instruction has released its first assessment of Wisconsin schools since before the pandemic. The DPI report cards released earlier this week show that although test scores have declined since before the pandemic, 95% of school districts in the state met or exceeded expectations. But the DPI changed its metrics and goals for schools in order to adjust for the wide-reaching effects the pandemic has had on schools. We're talking about the state of Wisconsin schools, how the pandemic continues to affect them, and how to measure the impact of the pandemic on schools and how much kids are learning. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a kid in Wisconsin schools? If so, how did the pandemic impact their learning? Have you noticed learning gaps? Maybe they kept up even through remote learning. If you're a parent, a teacher, a student yourself, what has the return to normal, quote unquote, been like for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alan Borsak is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School and an education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Alan, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Always glad to be here.
All right. There's this report card, and there's a lot of yeah buts as you look at it. Big picture, Alan, as you look at this thing, I mean, can we glean useful information about what happened to learning during the pandemic from it?
Yeah, but that's a good way of summarizing things. Yeah, there's useful information in there, but you don't need me to tell you that last year was really abnormal, and this year ain't so normal either. So that has to be considered in any assessment of how kids are doing, whether it's enrollment, whether it's test scores, whether it's, in this case, report cards, which are supposed to bring together a lot of data about schools, both district by district and individually. So they're all, just this enormous asterisk. That said, yeah, you can see a picture emerging here, and it's not too surprisingly, it's got a lot of reason to be concerned. Almost everything was down last year, especially at schools that were not in person for large hunks, if not all of the year. That's not, frankly, I'm not going to take a stand on whether that was a good idea or not compared to COVID. Mm. But there's no question there was an educational price paid overall, and you can see it in the data here.
What kind of things do you see in the data that show that cost? I mean, I think there's a general consensus that there is a hit, but is it a blip? Is it something long-term? As you look at the data in this report card, recent test scores, what kind of things worry you from what you're seeing?
Well, enrollment statewide is a serious issue. there were a large number of children, young children, 4-, 5-, and 6-year-olds, kindergarten and first grade, that were not in school last year, and a lot of schools were expecting them to come back this year, that the parents maybe kept them home as a precaution and out of fear last year. In the case of, say, a district like Milwaukee, which still the big kid on the block when it comes to school districts in Wisconsin, there was some return, but not what was expected. Statewide, there was a slight decline in enrollment. In some places, there was substantial decline in enrollment this year. Ultimately, that speaks to a changing population in the state, but also changing interest in what parents are looking for in schools, or maybe increases in private schools and at-home education. It's a little too early to get all the data on that. But, there's change going on. And when it comes to academics, statewide and in many of the districts serving the highest need kids in Wisconsin, the picture was not pretty. A very large number of kids didn't take tests last year. I mean, if the state DPI had its way, it would have dropped all the tests and the report cards, but the federal government wouldn't allow that, and state law didn't allow that. And scores were down. Reading scores were really pretty terrible. Math scores were not so great. Everything had down arrows last year, and even if there's an understandable reason for that, it has to be regarded as very concerning.
Republicans in the state legislature are looking for a new reading assessment, a new test for kids with that reading gap, that reading loss in mind. What do you think of that idea and the best way to do it if we do that?
Well, their proposal was to screen kids, give tests to kids at the early grades through second grade and identify them and give them more attention. A lot of this has to do with the legacy and the continuing nature of the so-called reading wars between whole language people and phonics people. It's a case where everybody's right and everybody's wrong in my book. Everybody's right in that there were flaws in the Republican idea, and there are certainly flaws in not doing anything. And everybody's wrong in, I sigh, obviously, that this seems, reading just seems to be like something, can't we all come together over reading? It's so obvious that something needs to be done. Reading scores are not good statewide. They're especially not good among populations of low-income kids and minority kids, Milwaukee, Beloit, Madison, Green Bay, you name it. I mean, in Milwaukee for many, many years, only about 20% of kids in both private and public schools were reading at a proficient or advanced level, and it just hasn't changed. They say, isn't this something we can come together around? And yet, in this highly polarized, highly partisan world, and especially within the Capitol in Madison, that just doesn't happen.
We're talking about the state of education in Wisconsin post-pandemic. Alan Borsak is with us. He is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School and an education columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you seeing in your family, in your school, in your local district? Do you worry that a political divide is getting in the way of doing the best things for kids in schools and how they learn? What has 2021 looked like in your school so far? Whether you're a student, a teacher, a parent, what are you seeing? Is there a lot of learning loss, do you think? Are you bouncing back? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alan, is there something with a proven track record that if people did come together, say in the Milwaukee district when it comes to reading, do we know what would work?
Again, we get back to the reading wars. In my book, what really works is obviously really good teaching, and sometimes that can be from a whole different set of approaches. It can be an array of approaches, but really strengthening teaching of reading and the qualifications for teachers and supporting them with mentoring and such is not going on very much and would really help. As far as specific approaches, you've got very strong advocates for what they would call the science of reading, which would be more oriented towards phonics and fundamental approaches. The state, what I would call reading establishment, which would include the organization called the Wisconsin State Reading Association, which is the reading teachers group and a lot of the unions and the State School Board Association, the DPI itself, are more into what used to be called a whole language, now has kind of been relabeled as balanced reading. I would feel better about what the establishment was doing if it was working, but there's just no change. They say maybe it's time to listen to people who want to do things differently because what we're doing isn't going so well.
You mentioned the partisan divide over education. Obviously a big political football. We've had conversations on this show about, you know, the Virginia governor's race, critical race theory, political divides over masks. You and I have talked about the partisan divide in education over the years. Has it somehow managed to get even more divided than it already was?
Certainly seems that way. And you've got such heat, not, you know, I think maybe it's been a little overstated about school board meetings where there's fist fights and that kind of thing. That's still fairly rare, but where there's big differences and really kind of a gridlock over doing things, that seems to be becoming more common, whether it's over race issues, the so-called critical race theory, over COVID policies. I mean, masks and testing and such, vaccinations, people just are extreme in their views. I was at an event last week with leaders of a bunch of different schools in Milwaukee, different streams of schools. Almost every one of them said to me, this year is worse than last year as far as stress, as far as just keeping things going, because they're trying to keep the schools open. They're just exhausted. You've got a number of schools, I think a growing number, that are going to take all of Thanksgiving week off just because everyone's so exhausted, especially the teachers. So it's tough out there, and it's this stress and divisiveness that's enhancing that problem.
Talking to Alan Borsuk, senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School, education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're looking at the latest news about schools in the state, their post-pandemic recovery, what's happening to test scores. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're connected with a school in any way, are you feeling that stress that Alan was just talking about? Is this a hard year for you, your student? If you're a teacher, a staff member at a school, are you feeling this? Is this year tougher than last year? If you have thoughts on the reading debate, phonics versus what Alan said used to be called whole language learning, love to hear from you as well. Do you have opinions on what it would take, thoughts on what it would take to make kids better readers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at student learning during the pandemic. New data on Wisconsin K-12 students came out this week. Education columnist Alan Borsuk stays with us, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are you seeing in your school, whether you're a student, a teacher, a parent, on the staff? What are things like in your community? Is this a rough school year, rougher than even last year, according to some? As Alan said, 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Kay is with us in Appleton. Kay, hello.
Hi. I'm an educator here in Appleton, and I know you're talking about the recovery to get our reading scores back up, but a lot of Wisconsin, as well as some of the socially economic, like, lower schools that we have, we're still not at a point that we can recover. We're still helping our kids with, like, their family members that might not be able to work with a whole bunch of things. We have kids that are homeless because of the pandemic and everything. So I know that you're talking about the recovery of everything, but what are we doing to make sure that we can still help support so that way we can eventually get to the recovery? Because a lot of our families that these kids are coming from are still in crisis.
Kay, if I could ask, it sounds like there's a lot of work there before you could even get to what we think of as education, right? You're trying to meet some needs before you could even start learning again.
Yeah, like, we really just have to be there for the kids. And so, like, what if you're saying that we're trying to get our reading scores back up already, what type of programs are going to help make sure that we can help support our families that are extra stressed still, and then also going to make sure that we can work on those things? Because we do that. We have so many facets of our job. I just don't see how we're supposed to be continuing already to help. We're just trying to get them sustained to try to get to their regular grade level reading, and it's still really tough right now.
Okay, thanks so much for sharing that. Alan, I'm guessing Kay's not alone in schools around the state saying, hey, we're just trying to catch up with the damage from last year, much less, you know, get back on track with learning.
I think what she's saying is really important, and I'm sure she's speaking for lots of teachers in lots of parts of the state. And it's important, but it's also sad because, I think COVID and COVID policy and fights over COVID policy and just the needs of kids and families have almost pushed aside normal learning in so many situations, or at least damped it down. And the reason I say it's sad is that I don't have a better solution. I mean, people's needs need to be addressed. Health comes first. At the same time, you say, hey, you know, you're only in third grade once. You're only in 10th grade once. And the loss that's going on, ultimately, there'll be a price to be paid for this in terms of people thriving educationally. I mean, I take it very seriously that successful schooling opens the doors to all sorts of things beyond schooling years. And I worry that we're just not going to have that door so wide open because we're paying such a price now.
Okay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Alan, we had a caller call in with a little correction for me. I think I used a phrase like post-pandemic or after the pandemic.
Yeah.
We're still in a pandemic here. How, and schools are still worried about, you know, health and masking and outbreaks, and we've had outbreaks in schools in the state and elsewhere. I mean, how much is this still existing pandemic weighing on what we can actually accomplish in classrooms?
Well, there's no one answer, and a lot of it, frankly, correlates with the political orientations of communities, that red Wisconsin is handling things differently than blue Wisconsin, masking policies and so on. The Marquette Law School poll, which just came out today, and that's one of the things I work on at the law school, found that nationwide, worrying about the pandemic is down among all groups compared to a year ago, but it's still pretty high. And it tends to be down much more sharply among Republicans than among Democrats. So it's still a big worry. I think if you look in the Milwaukee area, the blue communities are mostly still using masks in school and being pretty strict about it. And that's not only the public schools, but most of the private schools. And the red communities, the suburbs that are in the outer ring, Waukesha, Ozaukee County, and so on, are mostly not masking. Who's right? Man, I'm not going to answer that question. but it is taking a toll. So it's still tough. And in both cases, I'm sure, for the school leaders and for teachers, like the caller from Appleton, just keeping things going, keeping kids on track, dealing with the issues that people are bringing into the school building, both adults and kids, man, it is so difficult. It is so stressful.
Thanks for that comment at 800-642-1234. Talking to education columnist Alan Borsuk about the state of Wisconsin schools. Year and a half into the pandemic, seeing some declines in test scores, school report cards. Still time for your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Alan, though, I did want to ask about a piece you wrote a couple few weeks back. You went looking for some bright spots in the Milwaukee area, and you wish there were more, but can you highlight a couple of things you found that that gave you some optimism?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I was about to write based on the test scores that had come out statewide and for Milwaukee and the Milwaukee area. I was about to write what I thought would probably be the most depressing column I'd ever written because they were bad. And it happened to be the day that the Hmong American Peace Academy, which is almost 2,000 students and almost all of them are from Hmong ethnic backgrounds, really special school that's just boomed in the last 15 years, was dedicating a new high school wing, $30 million wing. It's beautiful. And so I went there saying, I got to say something positive. And then I named a number of other schools, and they do exist, and they exist in all three streams of schools in Milwaukee, the public school system, the private schools, and the charter schools have a disproportionate number of them. They tend to be schools that are very ambitious about what their kids are going to achieve. They tend to be very cheerful places. People think they must be really strict, hard-nosed places. Hardworking, dedicated staffs, very stable in their student enrollment. They don't have as much turnover as a lot of schools. The school culture, just the atmosphere in the place, which is actually a huge ingredient of a school success, is so positive. So there are a lot of schools, even before the pandemic, this is a long-time problem, where their goal seems to be just, let's get through the day. And then there are other schools where they say, we're really out to do great stuff, and you can see the difference in the two. So, yeah, I could name 15 schools off the top of my head in Milwaukee that I'd say, these are really good schools. Unfortunately, there's way more than 15 schools in Milwaukee.
Let's go back to our callers now. Katie is with us in Sheboygan. Katie, hello.
Hi. I'm a teacher. I teach not in Sheboygan, but close by. And I have a student whose parent just died last week from COVID, and her other parent is in the hospital with COVID. So, you know, one of the things that a lot of students are dealing with here is the emotional toll that it's taking. And the idea that they could continue learning through this is kind of crazy.
Katie, thanks for that call. Alan, we've had conversations on the show about the availability of mental health care for students pre-pandemic. A bigger issue, as Katie points out, is students dealing with grief and fear and confusion during the pandemic. Do you see that as a big part of the story?
Well, yes. And the situation she's talking about is obviously really, really sad and dramatic. But even a more routine situation of just the stresses of being at home all last year and being away from your friends and worrying about the future, the whole social emotional toll on kids is getting much attention nationwide. It's one of the few things that there was some agreement between Republicans and Democrats in the state budget to increase funding for social emotional services to kids and social workers and school psychologists and general services. So there's a lot of attention to this, but the need way outstrips what's available. That's pretty clear. So, yeah, it's a huge issue.
Katie, thanks a lot for that call. And our last, just under a minute or so, Alan, what do you have your eye on next to see how schools are recovering here?
If they can stay open, as we know, the numbers are high and rising in Wisconsin. So if schools in large numbers have to close, and just if there's gauges of how much can the needle be moved, and it's not easy, back towards focusing on education and not just keeping some stability in lives that are so unstable. So my hope would be things will ease. Was that really going to happen? I don't know. But we'll pay a big price on a certain level if we don't educate kids, and that's an enterprise that's very difficult at the moment.
Alan, thanks again for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Alan Borsak is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School and education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Joined us today for a look at the latest data on K-12 student performance in Wisconsin and how schools are trying to recover after a year and a half of pandemic. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, a lot of church congregations around the country are being split by political divisions. Join Kate Archer-Kent and her guests for a look at partisanship in the pews. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Turn around, bright eyes, because tonight, technically early Friday morning, you can see something special in the sky. Not a total eclipse of the heart, but a partial eclipse of the moon. It's a lunar eclipse when the moon passes into the Earth's shadow. It's going to be the longest partial lunar eclipse event in 580 years, according to space.com. The moon will look weird. And here's some good news from producer Bill Martins, Central Times weather nerd. Can I call him weather nerd? Let's just say weather fan. Most of Wisconsin should get a good look at the eclipse, just partly cloudy skies on tap for most of the state. Here in Wisconsin, you can start watching the eclipse a little after 1 a.m., no special eye protection needed, but Bill says bundle up warm. Going to be cold around the state tonight. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. The Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, traffic deaths in America hit a 15-year high this year. And despite local programs like Vision Zero, more people are speeding and driving drunk. Jen White shares your stories and finds out what's behind the surge. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, Moderna has gotten some criticism for mostly distributing its vaccine to wealthier countries. Now the drug maker is planning to make its vaccine more available in developing nations. In related news, Pfizer authorized its antiviral COVID pill to be manufactured and sold in 95 developing nations to make up over half the world's population. Still, the gap between poor and wealthy nations when it comes to vaccine access is huge. Under 5% of people in lower-income countries have received at least one dose of the vaccine. We're talking now about access to the COVID vaccine and to healthcare in lower income countries. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have friends or family somewhere in the world where vaccines are hard to come by? What are you hearing from them? Do you think lower income countries should have to pay for the vaccine, or should they be provided free or at lower cost? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Prashant Yadav is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, an affiliate professor of technology and operations management at INSAD. He is an expert in health supply chains. Prashant, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, you co-wrote a piece back in April of 2020 now, while vaccines were still hypothetical, that the world needed to plan for distribution of these vaccines in lower income countries. Did we ultimately fall down on the job?
Yes. So in April of 2020, we said, here are some things that we worry about. The scarcity in countries around the globe, which will not be able to access vaccines on their own. They will need some kind of financial support, some kind of purchasing support. And if we don't fix that, we're going to put everybody in the world in peril. And that didn't happen for a variety of reasons. I think people tried, governments around the country, supranational entities, such as the new COVAX mechanism, which was created. But just the sheer scarcity of production and supply has not allowed us to do many of the things that we had laid out in our April 2020 article. And we still continue to face that as a problem.
And we have Moderna saying, yes, we're going to take a step, or we've got a deal in the works to distribute a vaccine in developing countries. What are you looking at as companies like Moderna and the other big vaccine manufacturers try to ramp up production and then point it in the direction of these countries that are very much under-vaccinated?
Yeah, so I think announcements such as what Moderna made for putting the doses that need to go into developing countries ahead of the orders that need to be fulfilled in high-income countries, and similar announcement by Pfizer, other companies which have highly efficacious and safe vaccines. I think those are our only chances of solving this in the short term. Because in the short term, we need vaccines from companies who have large established manufacturing sites, and all we're asking is of the output that's coming out of those production lines, can we send some of that output to the countries which have very low coverage versus keeping that output as buffer or as additional stock just in case for high-income countries. And we shift to the medium term, then I think we start seeing a different picture. Then we ought to think about not just getting some of the production output from the large factories that Moderna and Pfizer, BioNTech and others have created, but also think about should there be manufacturing plants in regions of the world which haven't had sufficient access, whether it's in Latin America or Africa or some parts of Central Asia, and what would that look like? How would we create that? So I think there are two issues here. One is a short term and one is a medium term.
How about distribution now? Once vaccines hopefully get to some of these countries, these lower income countries, is there the public health infrastructure in place to get those shots delivered to people before the shots expire?
Yeah, so there are two things at play. One is, I think this is the kind of thinking which made us worry about, should we be using Pfizer, BioNTech, or Moderna's shots in developing countries which don't have the kind of infrastructure that is needed? They require ultra cold chain. We don't have that. And that, in a way, put the developing countries at the back of the queue because we didn't necessarily prioritize such vaccines for them. So yes, infrastructure is a challenge. The current infrastructure in many of the countries is designed largely for vaccinating kids. So it's a routine immunization for children. Converting that to vaccinate adults is not straightforward and simple, but it's very doable. And many agencies are working on it and are doing it. That doesn't mean the problem has been entirely solved. But at the same time, I think the dynamic that because there isn't enough infrastructure, we should therefore wait and hold on to the doses because until we have the infrastructure ready, let's not send it. That keeps us stuck in the circular reference problem as to let's not send the vaccines, we don't have infrastructure, but we don't have infrastructure planning in place because we don't know when vaccines are coming. So I think we've got to live with the infrastructure that we have. We have to do something ingenuous, creative, and we have to do something which is frugal and make it work with whatever way we can.
I've heard some public health concerns that if we have very large unvaccinated problems here in the United States or anywhere in the world, it raises the risk of new strains of COVID being able to evolve. It ends up becoming a threat, maybe even to countries that are better vaccinated. Do you hope that that line of thought kind of lights a fire under people and gets them to try to solve these problems sooner than later?
Yeah, I think the science is clear on this. I mean, as long as there are large populations around the world who remain unvaccinated, there will be new variants. We know some of the new variants that have come up, where they evolved from, and such variants will continue to emerge. And our sense of belief and confidence that because we have a large part of our population vaccinated with two doses, or in some cases with the third booster dose, we are safe. I think that will be eroded. That confidence will get eroded quickly once we have more variants emerge. So I think it is important to keep in mind that unless we can solve it for many countries where the vaccination rates are really low, we are not going to see an end to this pandemic, or even a state where we can all start feeling safe. Now, that doesn't mean that just providing vaccines to the countries is the only challenge we're facing. There have to be other things such as creating demand, solving vaccine disinformation, and other things in those countries.
We're talking to Prashant Yadav about lack of access to the COVID vaccine in lower income countries around the world and the effort to overcome that hurdle. Prashant is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development and an expert in healthcare supply chains. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how this all works, how to get vaccines to countries all over the world, even where there's not much access right now? What do you think should be done to make the COVID vaccine more accessible in poor countries? Do you think wealthier countries or the pharmaceutical companies should foot some, all of the bill when it comes to making vaccines available in countries that maybe can't afford to buy them all? Call in now at 800-642-1234. If you're from, or if you have friends or family in one of these lower income countries that doesn't have access to vaccines, love to hear what you are seeing. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk now with Prashant Yadav. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development and an expert in healthcare supply chains. We're talking about access, lack of access in many cases, to COVID vaccines in lower income countries around the globe. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions on the topic and maybe your experiences, or if you have contacts, friends or family in countries with less access to vaccines, love to hear what's going on at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Prashant, are you optimistic that these hurdles are going to get overcome anytime soon, by the end of this year or early 2022?
I am optimistic about some things, but I'm not as optimistic about others. So, for example, we are seeing a lot of progress on vaccine companies, prioritizing developing country access. More importantly, the U.S. government donating, or at least prioritizing, vaccines from both Pfizer and Moderna, the COVAX initiative trying to get more supplies. So on vaccine supplies, things are progressing. There are, like you pointed out earlier, there are still some infrastructure constraints that we need to have a more systematic look at to overcome them. But then I think there are also things such as syringe shortages, which have recently come to light. And I think this is something we've talked about before, that the specialized kinds of syringes that are required, for example, for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine in countries which require injection safety, so they require syringes that are auto-disabled. Now we are running into a very scarce supply situation for syringes. So I think we have to solve a lot of problems together with a systems view. And sometimes my worry is, or my slight lack of optimism is, in trying to solve one bottleneck, we solve that problem and then something else pops up dynamically. And then are we going to be able to solve all of them together? Another promising thing is the oral pills that have come out, the antivirals, both from Merck and from Pfizer, and the work that the two companies have done in licensing them out to a large number of manufacturers. I mean, that is promising. That may create access at least to the oral treatments quicker than there has been for vaccines.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Sid is with us in Green Bay. Sid, hello.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Sid?
Yeah, so I think this is a really interesting conversation that you guys are having right now. I'm originally from India, and I've been in the United States for the last 7 years. I work and live in the Green Bay area in Wisconsin, and it's amazing how stark the difference is in the vaccine rollout here versus in a country like India, right? I think the guest spoke about how pharmaceutical companies should be or can they bear the brunt or take over the expenses of actually having vaccines distributed and produced and distributed in developing countries, right? I'm not sure if that could be a good approach, but I think what the developed countries can do is that they could make sure that the vaccines at least are reaching these developing countries. My mom and my sister live in India, and they were able to get their vaccines because they were probably like the first in line, and they were really proactive about getting their vaccines first. I have a bunch of cousins who had to wait for months and months to actually get their vaccines.
Sid, thanks a lot for calling in. And I wanted to bring up, actually, India, Prashant, so thanks for bringing that up, Sid. India, as I understand it, has a pretty big pharmaceutical manufacturing base. A lot of the world relies on India, but India needs vaccines itself. What are you watching for in that country?
So India, in some ways, is a place which has a lot of manufacturing capacity for vaccines. Some of that they have put to use for making COVID vaccines. In that sense, for countries in the income category of India, which is, you know, lower middle income countries, India is probably the farthest ahead because of its own manufacturing. But at the same time, India has a large population. And for being able to vaccinate more than 1 billion people, this required far more capacity than perhaps what the government of India could put to bear for COVID vaccines. And in a sense, what it did was that India, which is also the big vaccine factory for most of the developing world. So in the developed world, we get our vaccines from companies that are located in the US, in the EU, in Japan, and other places. But when you go to developing countries in Africa and Latin America, many of the vaccines do come from India, the childhood vaccines. So India stopped exporting for some period of time when it was focusing its own populations first. And that meant the global initiative called COVAX, which was designed to provide vaccines to countries around the world, didn't get sufficient supplies from India. And that put everybody in a state of jeopardy. But at the same time, it was understandable for India to do what it was doing, which is to prioritize and get the billion people in India vaccinated. So it was a very challenging dilemma that the government of India had faced. But at the same time, to answer Sid's question, I think India has a far better situation than many other countries do. India also has a couple of homegrown vaccines that they've developed, one which has been approved, a couple of them which are under development, one large manufacturing company, another one coming up. So I think things look quite promising in India. I think what we want to see is India continuing to play its role as the vaccine factory to the world and exporting to countries in Africa and other places, and then also other countries to emulate that model and create their own vaccine manufacturing networks.
Sid, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Jane in Madison. Jane, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, Jane?
I have a comment. I have been thinking about the lack of vaccine development in other continents like Africa. I've not heard of any manufacturer of vaccines in Africa. I was wondering if it would be feasible for companies such as Pfizer to have a subsidiary in continent that, like Africa, maybe South America, that does not have manufacturing ability.
Jane, I got you. We don't have too much time left. But Prashant, what would you think of an existing company like a Pfizer getting some capacity in Africa to manufacture their vaccines?
Absolutely. I think that's a direction, that's a line of thinking we all have to focus on. I think both Pfizer and Moderna and Pfizer's partner BioNTech have announced plans to start their manufacturing partnerships in Africa in more than one location, in South Africa, in Senegal, and Rwanda. But the big question remains, what will be the timeline for it? To have such plants, we need workforce. We need people who know chemistry, who know manufacturing, who know laboratory, who know regulatory startup. So that workforce development is not at a stage where you can have that going right away. Also, to set up these plants, you need to think about what will they do after COVID. So will these plants run completely dry after the demand for COVID vaccines starts to dissipate a little bit? Or are we going to design them flexible enough so then they can manufacture other vaccines, such as for yellow fever or diphtheria or other kinds of diseases? And if they do, then it may require slightly more capital expenditure. It may also require us to wait a little bit longer because the equipment then will maybe take a couple of months more. So those are complex trade-offs, which I think companies like Pfizer, others, their partners in Africa are dealing with. But then it's not just Pfizer, BioNTech, and the larger companies. There are also some homegrown companies in Africa which are coming up and saying, we want to try it on our own. So I think we've got to accept both models of how this manufacturing expansion in Africa, Latin America will happen.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Prashant Yadav, Senior Fellow at the Center for Global Development, looking at the effort to provide vaccines in lower-income countries around the world. Now, a few teams might stand out when you think about the most successful programs in sports. The New York Yankees for a while there, the Green Bay Packers, the U.S. women's soccer team, UW-Whitewater wheelchair basketball could easily join that list. Megan Hart has more on the return of a program that's won a combined 16 national titles.
Medalist Christina Schwab says there's a common misconception that wheelchair basketball is a slow sport, but you don't have to watch the Warhawks for long to figure out that's anything but true. Schwab is a Wisconsin native and now head coach of the women's team at UW-Whitewater.
When you come and the first time you see wheelchair basketball, you're going to notice the chairs and you're going to notice like all the contact and people falling down. And then once you get past that kind of like, whoa moment, you're going to realize that it's basketball.
Maida McCabe fell in love with the sport for its physical nature.
There's moments where we're all diving for the ball, we're falling over, we're crashing into each other. So it's very, very intense. And that's part of the reason why I like it, just because I'm very competitive.
Like other players, the freshman from Washington, D.C. says the wheelchair basketball program is a big part of the reason she's at UW-Whitewater. She's getting ready to play her first college game, with eight teams from around the country descending on South Central Wisconsin for a tournament that starts tomorrow. McCabe and her teammates lifted weights and tuned up their wheelchairs on Friday.
15 seconds, let's go! Push yourself!
She's a little nervous, but excited too.
I'm confident that we will do well and that we've grown so much as a team that we're going to do amazing.
But even more experienced players haven't seen much competition recently. Last season was canceled due to COVID-19. Junior Grace Altrock says it was really tough when the pandemic cut the 2020 season short just before the national championship. She's looking forward to this weekend.
I have family coming up from Nebraska because that's where I'm originally from. And so it's my 10th year playing, and so I'm just really excited overall.
Before she started playing wheelchair basketball in sixth grade, Altrock says she sometimes felt left out since she couldn't participate in sports.
I immediately fell in love with the sport, knowing that there are people that are disabled like me and that I can do everything that I want to do, but I just do it in a different way.
Altrock said it was a huge honor when she was recruited to play at UW-Whitewater. The Warhawks began their adaptive recreation program in 1973, and now two banners hang in the gym, highlighting their many titles. The UW-Whitewater men and women last won championships in 2016 and 2014, respectively. Freshman Cameron Poole says it means a lot to wear the purple and white.
Just the legacy that other players left behind. Hopefully, and I'll leave one of my own behind too, maybe a championship or two, maybe three. But it just feels great to be able to play for a university that supports the wheelchair basketball team as much as the one here does.
And for the Illinois native, something else helped set UW-Whitewater apart.
You know, I came here and I was like, what differentiates Whitewater from like a University of Illinois or a University of Alabama? We're a D3 school, so they can't offer, you know, athletic scholarships. They don't have all the big fancy facilities, but they turn out Paralympic athletes like crazy.
Five former UW-Whitewater players were on the U.S. men's wheelchair basketball team that won a gold medal at the Tokyo Paralympics this year. Schwab was on the sidelines as a coach. Senior Ryan Gladchuk began attending wheelchair basketball camp at UW-Whitewater when he was 12. There are some strong collegiate programs out there, but at a recent practice, he said the Warhawks are way ahead of most opponents when it comes to legacy. The chemistry major and his teammates practice every weekday morning. Plus, they complete 2 lifting sessions and 3 scrimmages each week. Players say wheelchair basketball at UW-Whitewater is just like playing any other collegiate sport. For Gladchuk, that includes the rush he feels competing at home.
There's a whole gym cheering for you, and your first experience at a home tournament is just so much more fun. You have all your friends and family watching you play, and everything you've worked for is like they can finally show it.
The tournament will take place tomorrow and Saturday in Whitewater. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, some people will hit the road or the skies to travel over the next month of holidays. We'll get the latest predictions on how many people are going to travel and lots of advice if you're thinking about buying a plane ticket. You can start the conversation right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know your travel plans or lack of same. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and our guest cookbook author says, let's keep Thanksgiving simple. Get some great ideas for a delicious holiday meal without a whole lot of hassle. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, are you confused about crypto? You've got lots and lots of company. We're going to help understand the basics of Bitcoin and other digital currencies and how big a financial player they might be down the road. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.